Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and happy Shabbat. Fellas, I wonder if you read the story of the white supremacist that thought it would be a swell idea to obliterate Jews down there in, I guess it was Poway is where the synagogue that he went to. He was a member of the Presbyterian Church of Escondido. Did you guys stumble upon the manifesto of Mr. Ernst?
No, I didn't read that, but I saw it on the TV. I mean, the TV reports I did see.
Yeah. 19-year-old kid. Dad's an elder in the Presbyterian church. I'm laughing right now that Asher has one of my shoes and deciding that don't leave it. Leave it. Excuse me, I don't want my shoe. My shoe. No, it was good. The nice thing is when you say leave it to Asher, she not only leaves it, she brings it over and then hands it to you.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a pretty smart 5-month-old puppy. So, anyway, Mr. Ernst, 19 years old. Dad's an elder in the Escondido Presbyterian Church. Kid's a member of the church. He left 4 or 5-page manifesto talking about why he was going to go kill Jews. And he said that this particular hunt of Jews, that he's given 4 or 5 weeks of prior preparation to. Now, mind you that this kid, he killed one Jew. It was an unarmed, elderly Jewish woman. She's probably in her 70s. Mm-hmm. That was his, as he would call it, his high score. Killed one unarmed old woman. He should be so proud of himself. Anyway, he essentially wrote in the manifesto every one of the conspiratorial lies that have permeated the history of Jews ever since Paul stained the first papyrus with his poisonous words. And, you know, from Paul and his conspiracy against Jews, particularly Yosha's disciples, then you have the Imperial Rome, and then the Roman Catholic Church, and then Muslims conspiring against Jews. And you go forward all the way to the Third Reich and its conspiracy against Jews. And the reason I'm just mentioning this is that everything from Jews killed the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
And she just shake her head and say, wait a minute. If Jews killed your God, then you ought to be worshiping Jews as opposed to a dead God. Let me figure it out. If these Jews are so unbelievable they can kill God, why are you worshiping God instead of Jews? Of course, it's the Imperial Rome, which morphed into the Roman Catholic Church, that killed the body of Yosha. But just, of course, the argument is that Jews control the media, they control the banks, they control everything, and that the Jews have gathered together, and that all Jews collectively are responsible for preying upon Gentiles, and that the reason the Gentiles are on the risk of being obliterated. Now, this kid said, you know, I'm fighting for the survival of my race. That the Caucasians are on the risk of being obliterated because of Jews. Now, you need to kill the Jews for Caucasians to survive. Now, mind you, the Caucasian army of the United States of America and military is bigger than the rest of the world's combined. Mm-hmm. The Jews, their military, they only use to defend that little slice of land that they call home. One of the things that was really interesting is that he was highly motivated by the story of Stephen. You ever heard of Stephen the Martyr?
Oh, yes.
Okay. It begins with Acts 6. Story's untrue. Beginning to end, every bit of it. Every bit of the story was made up by Luke to aggrandize Paul. There isn't one iota of truth in the whole story. You know, Luke was not cognizant of what the Torah actually said, so all of the facts that Stephen allegedly quotes, and that's the longest speech in the entire New Testament, apart from what Yosha says in the Sermon on the Mount. So if you take all of Paul's speeches and everybody's speeches, there's nothing longer than Stephen. And of course, this is allegedly happening in front of Paul. Paul is allegedly in the office, in the audience, where Stephen is giving this speech, and he's got a Greek name. He is evidently Greek, and he is in a Greek synagogue. The Greeks despised everything that had to do with the covenant and with the with circumcision. I mean, they despised it. I mean, to think that there were Greek synagogues in Israel is, of course, ridiculous. But every fact that he quotes, about trying to make his case, everyone's wrong. I can't get one right. Do you think that Luke would at least look it up to get his facts right? He didn't. And so you'd have to say, so if you got them all wrong, he's obviously trying to make some theological point on behalf of Paul. And, in the middle of this whole episode, all of the other rabbis throw their coats down so that Paul can walk on them towards towards Stephen. But, yeah, the whole story is completely and totally fabricated. There was no Stephen. He's not a martyr. The whole story's made up to aggrandize Paul. But anyway, that was the reason that this Nimrod decided, I'm going to go off and kill Jews. Motivated by a story that is just flat out wrong. And after a while, you've got to wonder how it is that people have been beguiled into believing the Acts of the Apostles and Paul's letters when they're just so obviously untrue. How do you hold up your Christian Bible and say this is the inerrant word of God when everything that is attributed to Stephen's long speech is inconsistent with what precedes it? Just like everything Paul said is a direct contradiction of what God had to say. But are you stupid? Are you irrational? Yeah, the reason I bring this up is that I've decided I was going to translate the first seven things that Dode wrote. And I finished the first, and the first was quite simply a direct assault against Pauline Christianity. It says, Paul's wrong, the Torah's right. That's essentially the first mizmor. The second is Yahweh railing against conspiracy. He says, what the world is wrong with you? Why would you advance such stupid notions? And I said, well, why is he, I understand why he begins the first mizmor with Dode attacking Christianity. There's 2.5 billion adherents. But why is the second mizmor focused entirely on debunking and castrating those who are conspiratorial? Do you have any idea, guys?
Well, that's where it starts, with a lie. And you keep promoting the lie. And that's all.
Yeah, that's
all
a lie.
Really
yeah, okay. Well, so is religion. Religion's a lie. Conspiracy is a lie. There's not one single conspiracy that's true. Not one. They're all lies. I'll tell you why. There are more believers in conspiracy today than there are religious zealots. There's countries like Russia and Great Britain where the overwhelming preponderance, in fact, the news reports say that everybody is conspiratorial, with 60% mired in it, but that everybody believing one or more. It's become
religion.
Man's modern religion.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And conspiracy, it's not just that it's the most prevalent form of battle today. And that's what conspiracy is. In fact, Yahweh is just so brilliant in his opening statement on conspiracy. Every aspect of it, from it's being untrue, that it's a blend of lies, to it requires the consideration of selective information, and that it's promoted by those who are essentially losers, whose lives are wholly unsatisfactory and unsatisfying. It's just devastating. And he nails it. Every aspect of that we've learned about conspiracy, he's got it. So I was wondering, why is it then, beyond the fact that it's the most popular form of Babel the world over, particularly when, Islam is really stupid. Scientology really stupid. Mormonism's really stupid. If you're born into it, maybe you're just precluded from being able to see it. But they're really stupid. But conspiracy, it's dumber still. And you really have to put your head in the sand and completely ignore all prevalent, rational, and reasonable explanations and just wallow in the absurd. And so I wondered, what is it beyond the popularity that would have God condemn conspiracy right after he condemns Pauline Christianity? You know what the oldest, most prevalent, deadliest, most delusional conspiracy is of all time?
What's the one about the Jews from out of
Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a manifestation of it, yes.
Yeah.
That Jews are responsible for debilitating Goyim. The Jews are bad. It goes way, way back before the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, of course, is a complete hoax. And by the way, the majority of conspiratorial nut jobs promote the absolute proven hoax that is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That's true. But the single most prevalent, deadly, popular, longest-lived conspiracy is blame the Jews.
Well, you know that in Egypt, when the Ptolemies took over and they wrote all this history that is modern-day Egyptology, mm-hmm. they wanted to please Ptolemy family, the Egyptians. So they came up with the Jews, all of a sudden became the Amalekites, scenario. And later they became the Hittites, which is ridiculous as well. And it's because they all disliked them, therefore they just transferred them over and they couldn't stand them.
Right.
Proves your point about the Greeks, and that goes back, well, to the Ptolemies, you know, before.
Right. It's all replacement theology. You know, it's Paul coming up with this myth that replaces the promises made to Israel. The Hebrew roots movement, it's African Americans saying, oh, no, we're really the right Israel. We don't know who these other people are. I know Fred Snell was one of those that was so caustic in his anti-Semitism. Yeah, that was his big thing. There really are no Jews. The people that claim to be Jews aren't Jews. I'm sorry, but no, it's the most prevalent, longest lived, most deadly and destructive, and probably the lie that God hates more than any other. Blame the Jews. That's why God hates it. Oh, there's other reasons, and we're going to get to the first chapter of Volume 3 ultimately, but and I list four different reasons why God hates conspiracy, but boy, seeing Ernst, this 19-year-old kid, and he had them all, every one of them, as to his justification for killing Jews. That's just pathetic. We're going to begin our study of Sodom. It begins, the two spiritual messengers, Wa Shanim HaMalach. So a pair of spiritual envoys. I love the way the story begins. So a pair of spiritual envoys walk into a bar. They walk into a bar. Came to Sodom, scorched and burning. In the evening, of course. It's a place that probably no one was awake during the day. Well, Lot, which means enveloped and intertwined, the one wrapped too tightly, who was encircled and cased and entangled, sat in the doorway of Sodom. So first thing I would ask is that, are you, Asher, leave it. Giant water bottle is the next thing. Who knows where she found the giant water bottle? She is a self-entertainment unit. She's just looking at me like, I found that. Why did you take it away from me? So, first of all, Kirk, you mentioned that you did a study of the letters of that comprise out of three letters. What does it mean?
It means a shield or barrier that keeps one from the doorway to life.
Not a good thing. Yep. It's translated as just scorched and burning. Yep.
Yeah.
But your definition from the letters is better. So two spiritual messengers came there. Yahweh didn't go into Sodom, did he?
No.
No. Two spiritual messengers came to Sodom in the evening. While Lot, enveloped and intertwined. Who would have thought that name would mean so much? What it's saying is, pay really close attention to how the central character of this story is enveloped and intertwined in all that is wrong with Sodom. How he's wrapped way too tightly and entangled in this horrible place. So, the very first thing you ought to be doing is don't look at this story as Christians do, as Lot being a righteous dude that's symbolic of the Christian church being raptured. That ain't what this story is about at all. Because I want to tell you, Lot ain't no righteous dude. No. And if this is the idea of the harvest, then it's a really twisted concept because, well, his wife goes out there with him, and, well, she didn't even get an hour out of town, and it has nothing to do with her turning around. We're going to find out it's because she longed to go back. She longed for the life that she lived in Sodom. And the two daughters got daddy drunk and had sex with him. Had their way with him. Yeah, had sex with him. So, and when it's time to leave, Lot doesn't want to leave. When it's time to go to the right place, which is Mount Moriah, and to get out of Dodge and to hang out with Uncle Abraham, he don't want to go. He lives in a cave. Gets drunk. He's so miserable. So, you ought to be really careful if you're a Christian, saying, this is the story of our rapture, because, it's a twisted tale, and yeah. As is the case with the proponents of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Lot remained enveloped in the mire and muck of man's corruptions, way too wrapped up and entangled in religious, political, social, and even familial norms to have the tenuous relationship with Abraham prevail. Now, that's really important. Christianity and Islam will both claim to be Abrahamic religions, right? Mind you, Abraham didn't have a religion. But they'll claim this connection with Abraham. Now, it's absolutely untrue with Christianity and absolutely untrue regarding Islam, but they both claim it. Is that not the only thing that Lot's got going for him? Do you think that God would have sent to Malak to pluck Lot out of Sodom if it hadn't been for his relationship with Abraham?
No.
No, not one chance in a billion, billion, billion. That's all he's got going for him is his relationship with Abraham. And so you want to be really careful if you think you have an Abrahamic religion and that's going to be enough. Has been enough. Mm-hmm. Now, as it relates to Lot, yeah, he realized that Sodom was evil. He just didn't realize how much he was ensnared and entangled in the Sodomite web. He hadn't left on his own initiative, and that's really important. You know, Lot is not a story of salvation. This guy died in a cave, drunker than a skunk, having sex with his daughters. This is not a story of salvation. And so, the reason it isn't is that he didn't leave on his own initiative. That's the thing you got to do.
Yeah.
Before, well, even tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, JB, I'm would be interested in getting to know you. Before he taps Abraham on the shoulder, you know, he was way out of Babylon. And yet, Lot had every opportunity to leave. He didn't leave. By the way, that's one of the big things about the Stephen ministry thing to Stephen. His initial argument is that Abraham wasn't in Jerusalem. He wasn't in the temple. So that God doesn't live in some building here in Jerusalem. You can have a relationship with God anywhere. And he wasn't aware enough of the conditions of the covenant to know that God did not introduce himself to Abraham until Abraham made the decision to leave Babylon. And he then just left it. He was three-quarters of the way to the promised land. And all God said is, let me introduce myself. I want to offer you a relationship with me, but over here in Israel in the promised land. And Stephen missed all of that. And his point was, well, you can be with God anywhere. You don't have to be focused on this God-forsaken Jewish place of Jerusalem. God doesn't live in some temple building. It's not his home. Oh, wrong. You missed the whole story. So, he hadn't left on his own initiative. That's essential. He was content to live in the darkness of hell's doorway. But keep in mind, Lot chose this place. when Abraham offered his nephew the option of where to live, he said, you know, this is big territory. You can go left, you can go right. Whichever one you choose, I'll choose the opposite. Lot got first choice, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He chose this place. When Lot, the one wrapped too tightly, who was encircled, encased, and tangled up, he rose, standing up, to meet them. Then, on his own initiative, he made an announcement, explaining himself, because indeed, he was opposed to the material world. Okay, now, first of all, where was Lot?
Is it a gateway?
Yeah, the doorway.
City. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, it was like, I'm 1 foot in, I'm 1 foot out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He wasn't outside, he wasn't inside, he was right there in the doorway. 1 foot in, 1 foot out. By the way, that's the first of a number of doorways. We'll have to count them as we go through this. So Lot rose when he saw the two Moloch. He stood up. He hurled. Is there any other way to translate kum other than to stand?
No.
So why is it that every godforsaken Christian Bible translation then renders Chawa, he bowed down? He just stood up. Why? He's sitting at the gateway to the place. He stood up. No. What? Where is one's hand to bow? Exactly. He arose, standing up to meet them. Kara. Kara can mean to read and recite. Probably not reading and reciting here. It can mean to welcome them. It can mean to greet them. It can mean to summon them. It can mean to invite them. So he stood up to meet them, to greet them, to engage them, to encounter them. Then on his own initiative, this is written in the Histophel imperfect mood, which makes it clear that Lot was acting on his own initiative and that he was not being guided, controlled, or influenced by anyone else, that on his own initiative he made an announcement, explained himself. Here's what I'm doing here. Because indeed, he was also opposed to the material realm. He knew that what was behind him in Lot was really screwed up. He knew it was wrong. You don't think that most people don't recognize that there's something seriously wrong? You know, like there was a report, two or three reports out just this week. You know how I reported about 3 years ago that the least safe place to be a woman today is in the U.S. military. You're more likely to be sexually abused in the U.S. military than any other place on earth. And in addition to that, when you are sexually assaulted in the U.S. military, you're going to be assaulted again by the military brass if you complain about it. And so the U.S. military released its statistics, and you know how they all said, oh, don't take away the military code of conduct. Don't take away our ability to police and to judge ourselves. Don't have sexual assault in the military be under civil courts like it is for anybody else. No, we want to continue to be God and jury of everything in the military. We'll take care of this. Guess what? Sexual assaults in the military almost doubled.
You're sick.
So he knew. Anybody that's got their eyes open knows there's something seriously wrong with the U.S. military. There's something seriously wrong with the Justice Department and police officers. I know it. You know, there's something seriously wrong with the character of this country. Lot knew there's something seriously wrong. He said, I stood up, made an announcement. He explained himself. He verbally informed them, making his intentions known to them. Because indeed, he was also opposed to the material realm. Alf Eretz, because surely, that was a lot to say. And he, too, was extremely frustrated with this place. Alf Eretz. Now, while Alf, the second to last word in this opening statement, can be translated anger, frustration, nose, or nostril. It is most often deployed to convey that there is more to the story, something additional that needs to be said, which is indeed important and valid. This realization is informative in this context because the primary meaning of the word preceding it, chawa, is to make an announcement, explaining oneself. And by the way, the scholars agree that unless the word is scribed in the histophel stem, where they do an about face and say that, no, rather than confronting someone and explaining oneself, all of a sudden now, chawa means to bow down. Huh? But since the histophel stem confirms that no one is influencing, acting upon, or controlling the subject, that stem alone should have reinforced the opposite conclusion. Who bows down if you're not being compelled to do so?
Well, you just stood up to greet him. Why did, and then all of a sudden you fall
right.
On the ground?
Oh. Right. And you've got a stem here that says you're acting on your own initiative. Now, when you bow down before a king, when you bow down before a pope, you're acting on your own initiative. You're doing what is expected of you, because if you don't do it, bad stuff's going to happen. Such an individual would be standing up against the societal norm, not bowing down to it. But if you prefer the scholarly interpretations, evidence, and reason, after standing up to meet the Malach, Lot bowed down and prostrated himself, worshiping them with his nostrils to the ground. Now, requires you to ignore the primary meaning of every word to get there. Now, before we proceed, keep in mind that Lot was not present during any of the seven meetings between Yahweh and Abraham. And while he and his uncle may have spoken on occasion, Lot did not know all that we have come to know. Upon seeing the Malach, he realizes they are not like mortal men, and they, therefore, were sent by the Almighty. But tarnished by Sodom, he not only addresses them inappropriately and errantly positions himself relative to them, he inaccurately ascribes volition to individuals completely devoid of it. And this is something you have to be really cognizant of. The stories and the dialogue that are presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms are as they occurred. And so, Lot, who is clearly not Dode, he's righteous. He's not Abraham either. If he does something and says something that's indicative of the disgusting community in which he was raised, then we ought not follow that example. God's not telling us to follow his example.
Yeah. He's just recording.
Yeah. Just be aware that he was confused. He said, "Behold, I beg you, my lords, please, you should of your own volition change direction and come away from the immoral debauchery and fraudulent perversions toward your servant's house and choose to pass the night washing your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." Before we go on to the next, just think about how stupid all of that was. Now, is it really stupid, or is it just a difference between what we know versus what Lot knows? Okay, first, you would never plead with a Malach. Now, why wouldn't you plead with a Malach?
Because they follow instructions regardless.
That is correct. They're going to follow Yahweh's instructions, period, end of conversation. You have zero chance on influencing them. You know, I guess if you were to ask for a licorice popsicle as opposed to a cherry popsicle, and it was in Yahweh's purview to give you a popsicle, they're not going to give a hoot what flavor you ask for. That's your preference. But if it has anything that's important, you aren't going to deter them from their stated mission and instructions.
like they picked him up.
Second thing is, yeah. So, no reason to do that. Second of all, he is referring them to as lords, and he is begging them. Who is more important, Lot or the Moloch?
Well, the most powerful is Lot. But they sent him there for a reason, to save him. So he has some importance.
Yeah, that's, okay. Yeah, well, that's Satan. That was Satan's problem. Satan said, you know, I'm a lot more powerful. I'm a lot smarter. You know, I'm eternal. I'm so much better than man. Why in the world, God, are you so interested in this feeble, stupid, mortal construct that you created? And the answer is really simple. Moloch don't have free will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't. Yeah, they can't love. They can't be creative. They can't engage in a meaningful relationship. They can just do what they're told, or they can do not what they are told and be kicked out of the spiritual realm. That's it. So, rather than the Moloch, or Lot pleading with the Moloch, what we're going to find as the story goes around, it's the Moloch pleading with Lot, because Lot, even for all of his foibles, is far more important to Yahweh than the Moloch. Moloch don't need to be saved. There's nothing you're going to do with the Moloch that's going to benefit their situation. So he said, and behold, my lords, they aren't lords, but you know, also keep in mind, too, to call somebody my lord was very much like today. I'm working on my boat. I got 8 or 9 crews today. And 2 of them were Southern boys from the deep south.
Sure.
And, yeah, it was all yes, sir. And, you know, I hate being called sir. I really do. It just creeps me out.
Sorry.
You know, and I'm working harder than any of them, and I'm in a Florida sweat. And you know, I started at 5:30 in the morning, working on the boat, getting it prepared for the various crews that came in. And these guys come in, and you know, and I'm covered in dirt and dust and sweat, and they'll keep on calling me sir. But the point is that where a Southerner will say sir today. It's ingrained in them. People in yesteryear used the term, my lord. That's just the way they talked amongst one another. It was like saying, yes, sir. So he said, my lords, please. Now, here's the second please. This is Wa Omar Hina Na Adonim Na again. Please. You should, of your own volition, change direction and come away from the immoral debauchery and fraudulent perversions. Well, does Lot think that they're stupid? Do you think that they were out on a trick or treat? And they thought maybe this would be the place to go? If they're spiritual beings, they were sent there for a purpose. Don't tell them to go away. But Lot was embarrassed, clearly. And he uses the term, sure, go, turning away from this degenerate corruption called imperative, which is second person volition, toward your servant's house, Ebed Atta, your advisor and co-workers, Beeth, home, and choose to pass the night washing your feet. Then you can rise early and go on your way. Now, do you think that Moloch are concerned with personal hygiene?
No.
No. Do you think that the Moloch are going to go nighty-night and need a bed?
Neither.
No. Do you think that they're going to rise early in the morning and if they were here, where are they going? Why would they just be stumbling into town and go on your way? They came there for a purpose.
Yeah.
Don't send them away.
Or anything like that. They just go to where they need to be. They are light.
They just showed up. Lot was at the gateway to Sodom. They showed up at the gateway to Sodom. That's just how that works. But they said, no, by no means. Negating the notion, instead, we will stay the night in the broad, wide, and open way, in the limitless, pretentious, and public streets, within the gaping, this is Rakol, within the gaping living spaces which are agreeable and without pre-existing limits, opportunistic and expansive, improper and ostentatious, the way of those who boast their confidence in that which is overwhelmingly selfish. But when you hear broad and open way, what do you think that's symbolic of?
Versus narrow way, yes, God's way and the world's way.
Yeah. And when Yahusha was having that whole discussion with the the narrow and restrictive way that very few find that leads to life, and it's the broad and popular way that leads to death and destruction. Therefore, it's impossible that a religion like Christianity, which is the most popular religion of all time, could be true. But that whole Sermon on the Mount, this instruction on the Mount, was to negate, even before it began, Pauline Christianity. And the broad and open way, the popular way that leads to death, Yosha would have used this exact same word. Rakob is popular religion, particularly Christianity. So Lot was clearly embarrassed by Sodom, as we should be of our own communities. He did not want Yahweh's representatives to witness the fraudulent perversions and immoral debauchery lurking in the darkness of this place. By contrast, he viewed his home, as should we, as a respite from man's perversions, as a place reflecting the covenant's values. In his home, the Moloch would be sheltered from man's darkness and cleansed of his corruptions, such that they could rise with the light and go on their way. That was Lot's mindset. Now, these Moloch messengers had been dispatched to do a job, which was to remove Lot from Sodom. And that was going to have to occur before the place was torched. There were no options for these Moloch. That was their mission. They were going to accomplish the mission. And they were doing it at Abraham's request and Yahweh's behest. Curious as to what they would be destroying, or perhaps just trying to understand the reasons God had thought it best to remove this blight from his land, and it's in his land. Mm-hmm. They had intended to spend the night observing the broad and open way that leads to death and destruction. And I think that's telling of us, too, for us. We really should be cognizant of what's happening around us, even when it's disgusting. Now, there may have been an inference to Passover as the alternative to the darkness and death in the verb loon, pass the night. Now, since Moloch are spiritual, they're not material beings. They do not eat, they do not drink as light, and thus without darkness there would be no purpose to washing their feet. So perhaps with the mention of matzah, of a feast, and of being protected by washing man's corruptions away, and in the concert of Lot sitting in the doorway out of man's world into Yahweh's home, what follows may be the Torah's initial introduction to Pesach and Matzah, the door to life and the means to perfection. It would not only explain why Lot was so insistent that they enter his home, it would also explain why the Moloch were so readily persuaded. Now keep in mind, this story occurs at the single most important place in all of the Torah. Jimmy, if I were to ask you, what is the most important story in the Torah, what would you say?
Abraham's?
Yeah. Story of the covenant being formed with Abraham and then with the rest of us after him. That is the most important story in the entire Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Nothing even comes close to rivaling. Yahweh and Abraham had seven meetings.
And the reason it's called the beginning.
Yep.
That's where you start any book.
These statements that we're reading right now, they are in Bereshit 19. You did a lot of, in fact, you've written almost a full book on this subject. So you're probably aware of what is written in Bereshit 17, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, very much.
Yeah. Come on, tell us, what's the story of Bereshit 17?
It's Yahweh's largely focuses on, you know, the formation of the covenant and Yahweh's instruction involving circumcision.
That's it. Circumcision. Yahweh 17 is the sixth meeting between Abraham and the sixth meeting between them. And that meeting is circumcision, circumcision, circumcision. That's the sign of the covenant. If you aren't circumcised, you are not going to be a member of the covenant.
My covenant.
Right. You've negated my covenant. You're not going to be saved. You're not going to come into my home, which is in heaven. And you cannot participate in Passover, Matzah, and Bukkotim. And if you don't go through the doorway of Pesach, you ain't getting anywhere. That's the doorway to eternal life. That's 17, isn't it?
Okay.
This is 19. You know what 21 is? 21 is the test. 21 is when Yahweh says to Abraham, I want you to grab Yishak and I want you to go to Mount Moriah. And that's when he says, you know, don't take the life of your son. That's going to be my job. I'm going to do that. And that was exactly 40 Yobel before he did exactly that on exactly that place. Fulfilling Pesach. And so, this interrupts that presentation. It comes right after the fifth and final covenant, condition of the covenant, and right before the open book test on how it is that we know that we're part of God's family. So you think God's going to interrupt the single most important story, the story that is the basis for creation? I think he's going to interrupt it just to tell us about, well, this is a really horrible place down there. No. This is a really important story.
And no one was ever...
It's extremely important that we consider every aspect of it. And so, when you've got matzah being brought up in this next statement, focus on it. He said, but instead, Patsar Bahim, he persuaded them by pressuring and compelling them, pressing and pushing their buttons down. This is really important for Lot. Come into my home. Now, the Malak, we're still on a mission. Get Lot, the Sodom's going to be destroyed the next day. They got to get Lot out of Sodom, and you know their intent was, in the ancient world, you don't walk at night. There are no street lights. There are no flashlights.
Yeah. Right. Lots of wild animals.
Lots of wild animals, man. And so you leave in the first light is when they were going to leave. And so, you know, they didn't really care where they were going to spend the night. And so Lot said, you know, come in. Pressure them. Come into my home. Okay. You know, no big deal. He insisted to such an aggressive extent that they turned around and came to him and arrived at his house. And he made a feast for them and baked matzah on yeasted bread, and they ate. Now, first of all, I said, do spiritual beings need to eat? Answer is no. But it says here, hey, this is kind of the thing that gets Christians all tied up in their panties, is that when you say that there was no bodily resurrection, it's obvious. You know, his own mother didn't recognize him. Thought he was the gardener. He said, don't touch me. Oh, I have not gone yet to the Father yet. Why? I mean, put it together. Next thing we find is that he's teleports, if you will. Beam me up, Scotty. He meets two guys, 60 stadia, out of Jerusalem, and they don't recognize him. The road to Emmaus. He has dinner with them. And then he appears in the upper room walking through a wall, all say, oh, it doesn't have a physical body. It's impossible to do any of that with a physical body. And the disciples, of course, didn't recognize him. The story is really clear. He was not recognizable. He did not have a physical body. He was an energy-based being. But then they said, but, you know, he showed the wounds in his hand to Thomas, and then Thomas believed. Think it through, people. E equals MC squared. He was transformed into a spiritual being, an energy-based being, and when he wanted just to go with the ordinary flow of time, he simply translated part of his spiritual energy into matter. That's it. And by the way, if the best you could do is to recognize someone because of their scars as opposed to their nature, that's pretty pathetic. Do you think that any of us are going to recognize Yahweh because of the way he looks? Do you think we're going to recognize Dode because of the way he looks?
We're going to recognize them because of who they are.
Is not an accurate representation.
Correct. It's who they are. It's not the way they look. I had a friend point out, do you know how many variations there are on just the human genome? How many different kinds of humans there can be before you repeat one?
Yeah, I have no idea.
10 to 2,000 the power.
Wow.
It was 10 to the 80th power. I mean, I've told you this, 10 to the 50th power molecules in the entire universe. Well, if you break it down into even the component parts, gluons and leptons and electrons and protons, and then there's 10 to the 80th fundamental particles that you've been making up matter in the entire universe. You know, of 400 billion galaxies averaging 100 billion stars in each. And there's only 10 to the 80th power. And yet there are 10 to the 2,000th power variations of the human genome. We don't have to worry about it. There'll be another Kirk or JB out there. So, here they are, and they're having matzah. And he baked unyeasted bread, and they ate. So, there's something going on here. No. First of all, before Yah even lays down the instructions on matzah, what does he think that matzah appears in the story? Nobody breaks bread without yeast, right? It's just like you can't make beer or wine without yeast. Yeast was essential to life back in those days, but he made matzah. And the matzah is the only thing listed on the menu of this feast. And so we're dealing with unyeasted bread. Now, Yahweh was not, as Christians muse, using the situation to foretell the rapture, whereby an individual and his family were spared from the destruction of the world. He was instead using it to explain that even the worst of us can be saved when we observe the Torah's instructions to partake in Pesach and Matzah. We're going to learn all about Pesach because there's a number of doorways there. We can count them. But Pesach, and now we have matzah. By consuming the unyeasted bread, Lot and his family were seen as removing the pervasive fungus of religious, political, societal corruption from their souls. Now, how's that for foreshadowing?
I never had to think about it.
Yeah. Similarly, Christians are wont to suggest that God is negotiable, thereby inferring that he would accept the massive alterations that they made to his plan of salvation with their New Testament and its gospel of grace. In fact, Abraham did did not change Yahweh's mind or plan or his response to Sodom, not even to Lot. He had heard of their perverse screams and had decided that he could not tolerate this malignant infection to fester and grow in the promised land. The people in place would be and were destroyed. And though Lot, the one who was entangled in all of this, through him, Yahweh would reveal one of the most vividly painted pictures ever portrayed about human nature. Now, since the Malach, the spiritual beings and messengers, are especially germane to this story, should you be curious, and we talked about this just a moment ago, how an energy-based being could eat, could lie down, the answer is found in Einstein's equation, whereby they can become matter when greatly reduced. As spiritual beings, they were capable, as the covenant's children will one day be, of re-entering the ordinary flow of time to celebrate the Mikra. We're going to do that too. The Mikra are on a time schedule. Time only flows around matter.
When there's matter.
Right. You know, that's the thing that always perplexes me. As scientists say, well, the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And, of course, they come up with that number because of the microwave radiation from the Big Bang. But the math that is used to determine that requires one to speculate as to the temperature of quark environment. They chose the number that would make the universe the youngest, but there's a more likely number, the middle number of what we think of quark environment, than have the universe being 15 billion years old. But keep in mind, that timeline isn't from the Big Bang to now. You know, scientists say, well, it's just a tiny fraction of a second that that all of this transpired. No. Time simply did not flow until the energy released at the Big Bang cooled sufficiently for energy to coalesce as matter. Otherwise, it doesn't flow. So it's really important to understand how E equals MC squared and time all relate through Einstein's theories so that we can come to understand what was physically happening here. Even before they laid down, men of the city, individuals from Sodom, surrounded the house, including young boys, and perpetually predatory old men. All the people to the last. That sounds a little bit like forecasting Islam because the women folk, they weren't allowed out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But you had the men. And what Yahweh is saying here too is that he wiped out the entire place. Young and old. And he's saying that the perpetually predatory old codgers and the youngsters were all the same. So every last one of them was corrupt. So anyway, he says that all of the men, without exception, of Sodom, from young boys, adolescents, teenagers, and perpetually predatory old codgers, all to the last gathered around Lot's house. You know, it's not every day that you see a Malach waltz into town. They wanted to talk to him. They wanted to know what was going on. And my guess is, you know, if you ever take the time to speak to a Christian about Yahweh, the moment you say something that is caustic to what they believe, in fact, even before you do sometimes, they'll spout out whatever they believe. And I believe, well, that's not what it means to me. What it means to me is, this is what I believe. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to tell these supernatural beings, this is what we believe. They wanted to sell their case. This is why, you know, today, gay pride parade. No, I've got nothing against homosexuality. If you want to be homosexual, almost everything. You know, those that marched in protest, we won the Black Lives Matter. We want you to believe what we believe. That's what's happening here. They didn't come out because they wanted to rape these Malakas. No hint of that whatsoever. They came out because they wanted to impress on the spiritual representatives their agenda, their beliefs, their opinions. That's what people do. This is to say that mankind's means of corrupting people, religious, political, and societal, even familial, pervasive, often, as is the case with the situation here in Sodom, only three people would be spared. And even with them, they were never able to fully extricate themselves from this morass of human perversions. Everyone else, right down to the children, and of course including the seasoned citizens, especially the perpetually predatory elder statesmen, the religious clerics, and the community leaders, all of them were rotten. And with Sodom serving as a metaphor for today's society and for our Moab, the people's political, religious, societal, familial, and moral beliefs need to be seen as malignant. It's a condition that was affecting all of humankind. And it's one that would remain to the end of time, to the very last. And so they would all die as a result. You know, Sodom was in Israel. Moab is in Yahweh's home when he returns. That's why it has to be eradicated. You will note that on this particular occasion, as will be the case during the time of Jacob's troubles, the entire community was outside wanting in. It'll be the case with Christianity. They're going to be outside wanting in. They had encircled the home, which had just celebrated unyeasted bread, and they wanted to know and become familiar with the spiritual beings inside. But they were precluded from entering. Lod would open the door and then shut it behind him. It was the door to life. The door to God's home representing Pesach. Now, you ever wonder why there were two messengers? What do you think, guys? Why two? Why not just send one? Why two?
Who's a witness, but it's also what they're going to do at the end. It foreshadows the end of Jacob's troubles in the story.
What happens at the end of Jacob's troubles? Right. And what does Yahweh say about Moab? That it's Moab is Sodom. Sodom is Moab. Moab is the modern incarnation of the ancient kingdom that Yahweh is going to destroy. And so, just before he destroys Moab, he sends two Malak, right? Or, in the case, two witnesses. So what he's doing is saying, I'm foreshadowing what's going to happen at the end, just as I'm going to send two witnesses, Eliyahu being one of them. I don't know who the other one is. Going to send two witnesses. Just as he's going to send two witnesses, he sent two messengers to Sodom, because Sodom equals Moab. And Moab is this blend of poly-Christianity and modern multicultural, politically correct, socialist, secular humanism. And that's the world that Yahweh is returning to. There'll be two witnesses. And one of the things that has just always been interesting to me is, why is only one of the two witnesses named? We don't tell you. We're not told who the other one is. And I have speculated, and I think Christians love to speculate, because Enoch, whom we know nothing about, was just taken by God, that he's going to be the other, because, you know, it's appointed for everyone to die. I wouldn't go there. We don't know enough about Enoch, and Enoch doesn't know enough to fill this role. Eliyahu is the perfect individual to fill the role as it relates to Yisrael. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of you have studied Eliyahu's adventure with the priest, the high priest of Morpheel. And Morpheel means the Lord of the Broad and Open Way. He is a hoot, man. He said, maybe your God's, you know, taking a bathroom break. I've got all day. I'll wait.
I have done a few of that. I do love his sarcastic sense of humor.
He is so sarcastic. He is so on his game. He's perfect. And clearly, he knows the Torah. And he knows Israel. And he knows the ancient belief systems that grew out of Babylon that were tormenting Israel. He's perfect. We're not told the other one. A lot of things have happened since Eliyahu and the prophets. There is no more kingdom of Assyria or Babylon or Egypt. The religions now are Christianity and Islam, socialist, secular, humanism. That's not Eliyahu's or the other's wheelhouse. So there's a reason we're not told. Obviously, the name of the second witness is irrelevant. And they called out to Lot, the one wrapped too tightly, who was encircled, encased, and entangled. And they said to him, where are the individuals who, to show the way to the relationship, came to you this night? Choose to bring them out to us, so that we can fulfill our desire to become acquainted with them. So, at this point, do they have disorderly mob? No, they're using their words, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah, call out to him. Kara, Lot. Hey, Lot. Where are they? You know, high-ish individuals who, to show the way to the relationship, Asher, came, Bo, to you, El Ata, this night, ha, Yael. Choose to bring them out to us. Yatsa, Him, El Ano. Produce them, such that we can have sex with them, such that we can rape them, such that we can engage in homosexuality. Oh my God. Isn't that what the Christian pastors would have you believe, that Sodom was destroyed because they were homosexuals? What's the verb here?
Yada.
Yada. Yeah. What's the primary meaning of yada?
No. To know and understand intimately in a relational way.
Right. To be acquainted with, to understand, to know. Yes. We want to know about these guys. We want ourselves to be known to them. Yahweh has words. You know, when God talks about sex, well, he's got no problem with sex. Paul had a problem with sex, but God doesn't. When he talks about sex, it's interesting that the word that he uses is the same word that we use today. Bo means to come. When Lot's daughter, I don't want to get graphic here, but I just want to point out that when Lot's daughters decide that they're going to have sex with dear old daddy, they don't use yada. I want to know him. No. They say, we're going to come. Bo. Bo's not what's used here. It's yada. They wanted to be known to the Malach. They wanted to know the Malach. This is not an act of sexuality. Yeah, it's just amazing how Christian doctrine can be based on such horrible translations. familiar with, well, your knowledge to understand.
The argument that they would make, and I think it's actually wrong, it's a misunderstanding, is it's actually used in terms of like Adam and Chawa. It says that Adam, Yada, and Chawa, and then it goes on to speak of them bringing forth their children. And so they would argue that that's why it means to have sex. No, it means he came to know her better. Yeah,
right.
Their relationship grew, and that eventually led to children. It's used to speak of the growing of that relationship, not of the act.
Once upon a time, we were probably all single, we probably all dated. Yeah, exactly. We're all single at one time and dated at one time. And I'm one to tell you that if I engaged in intimacy with a woman prior to getting to know her, that relationship was really short-lived. It just doesn't work. You just can't go back. You've got to do things. And I'm not one of these that says, you should take forever. You need to know somebody before you have intimacy. It's just that there's lots of things that have to occur in a relationship in parallel. And that's one of them. And if you get anything out of sync, it's really hard to go back and make it right again. And so you're right. He had to get to know her before there would be intimacy and children.
Yeah. Was a relational term there, is how his relationship grew with her, not an actual act.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, there is a word used many times for the act. It's described a lot, and it is not yada.
Right. It's Bo. Come.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means to arrive, to come into. Let's be clear. The intent of the Sodomites was to engage the Moloch in conversation. And while their lips said, we want to become acquainted with them and know and understand them, those who are prone to group speak, to shouting, are seldom open to listening or learning. Given the opportunity, these men would have tried to persuade the Moloch such that they would accept and embrace their viewpoints and faith, their conspiracies and philosophies, their values and merit.
So true.
And so, Lot.
So there were the Mormon missionaries and Jehovah's Witnesses of the town.
That is correct.
Going door to door.
Yeah, they weren't there to listen. Yeah. In fact, if you confront a Jehovah's Witness and say, there's no J and no B in Hebrew, and it's Yahweh, not Jehovah, they're out the door.
I've done it.
If you tell a Mormon that, guess what? The DNA proves that the earliest Americans were from Russia and Mongolia, and they came across during the last ice age, and that there isn't any Jewish DNA amongst the early Native Americans, the Book of Mormon, its primary premise is false. They're out the door.
I mentioned that since we have the Rosetta Stone, the text that, what's his name?
Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith claimed to translate was not a Book of Adam, it was the Book of the Dead.
That is correct. So, enveloped and entwined at the doorway, went out to them at the doorway, shutting the door behind him, saying, please, no, certainly not. I beg you, my brothers, this is bad. Ra'ah, this is disturbing and distressful, troubling and harmful, ruinous and destructive. This is wrong. It's invalid. What's wrong? If they wanted to listen to the Moloch and learn from them,
that'd be something else.
That wouldn't be wrong, would it?
No, not at all.
No. So, Lot recognized, as should we, that what the townsfolk wanted to do was impress the Moloch on the superiority of their way. And their approach was entirely wrong, completely invalid, and indeed ruinous, destructive, and that is because they wanted to do things their way, not God's way. While Lot had been inside celebrating matzah, the Sodomites were out in pursuit of fulfilling their desires, and that is why the door to Lot's home, the doorway for those being saved by God, indeed representing the doorway to Yahweh's covenant home, was shut.
Good.
Now, there was a parallel to this in the quasi-historical musings of Luke, who, after having studied the story of Stephen, and it's amazing how many people figured this out. I don't know why it took me so long. But and how the whole thing is just gobbledygook. It's all set up just to give Paul a veneer of credibility. That Luke is not an inspired writer on behalf of Yahweh. Anyway, in the book of Acts in 21:30, wrote about how the Yehudim and Jerusalem were up in an uproar. People came from all directions to seize Paul and drag him from the temple. This is a reenactment, of course, of the Lot story from Paul and Luke's point of view. And they wanted to close its doors. Saul, wanting to express his own way and distinguish it from God's way, willfully and belligerently violated Yahweh's Torah instructions. And he brought an uncircumcised Greek man past the courtyard into the temple, defiling it. Paul got to the door to Yahweh's home, slammed in his face, just like the men of Sodom. And the only reason Shaul questioned him was not beaten to death by the Israelites, was that after flaunting his Roman citizenship, another blot on his soul, a Roman soldier, rather than God or his Moloch, protected him. Yeah, Paul's Moloch, a Roman soldier. Now, what appears to be, to the uninitiative, to be another highly questionable father, perhaps setting a new low in parenting, Lot presented the contrast between the way of man and the message of God by using his daughters as a comparison. This is quite the statement here. He says, "Now I beg you, please, for contrast, consider my two daughters, who, to reveal the way, have not known a man and are unfamiliar and unacquainted with ignorant men. Asher lo yada ish, who, to reveal the proper and narrow restrictive path to walk through life to engage in the beneficial relationship, do not respect, nor do they acknowledge. They are not concerned with, nor do they know or choose, thereby remaining unresponsive, preferring the ignorance revelations of mankind. I want to bring them out of my own volition. It's my desire to produce and extend them, to bring this to an end and to finish it, to full and perfect cohortative, engaging them in such a manner that they both participate and become alike with ongoing implications based upon my free will. Right now, with them livening the narrative and calling attention to the details, Eth, Hannah, with them accordingly right here and now, providing a reference to behold for you. Do to them, engaging and acting as you desire. Do whatever you'd like concerning them, consistent with whatever you find good, moral, and beneficial in your eyes. Ha, tob, ba, ein. Now, I'm presenting this as a contrast. You can engage such that you can only engage consistent with what you would find good, moral, beneficial, productive, useful, and decent in your sight, pleasing, pleasant, effective, and generous. There is no even in Sodom. Rape was not seen as good. Even in Sodom. They were told they could interact with his daughters with the proviso that it was constrained to that which was good, pleasing, beneficial, productive, useful, decent, generous. There is not one chance in the world that you could define rape as Tob. Tob means good. It's amazing that this was constrained, and yet in the translations, that's not what you'll find. Then he said, only and exclusively, there's one thing you can't do. Regarding these individuals, to them, do not act or engage. By what? By raping them? No. By speaking to them. Dabar. By speaking, by making a statement, by communicating. It proves our initial point. What Lot recognized was wrong is that the townsfolk of Sodom were going to tell God all about their religion, all about their politics, all about their family values, all about their society. They were going to talk to him. It's like the Christian that wants to pray. What in the hell are you doing praying to God? What do you have to say that's going to be interesting to God when you won't even listen to him first? Why would he listen to you if you won't listen to him? Only exclusively regarding these individuals, do not act by speaking to them, by making a statement, by communicating the message to Bar, by saying something, by offering a pronouncement or a declaration.
Wow, I just looked at six different translations, and not one of them even acknowledges the existence of Dabar there. They all change it to don't do anything.
Right. Does Dabar mean do?
As if, no.
No.
I mean, not one of them even attempts to render it in any type of way. They just ignore its existence.
JB, you've done a lot of translating. Is Dabar a word that there are challenges in translating, or is Dabar about as common and straightforward as there is a word in Hebrew?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most, probably on the top 10 most common words you'll see.
Right.
It's pretty much straightforward what it means. You know, it's got a handful of nuances it can mean in certain circumstances, but it pretty much means speak, say, or word, or words.
Message, communication, statement, but speak. Say is typically amar.
Yeah.
You know, convey, ask, say would be amar. And speak, communicate, make a statement, convey a message is Dabar. Whether it's a noun or a verb. Dabar, D-B-R. Don't speak to them. Because, and for the express reason, how can they have come, Bo, into the shadow, Batisel, of my support structure. Okay. Shadow of my support structure. What time was it?
Night time.
What time was it?
Night. Evening.
Right.
Night.
Like the middle of the night right now, isn't it?
Hmm?
Are there any shadows in the middle of the night? I'm looking outside of my door here. I'm on the East Coast. I don't see any shadows. So is he talking about shadows?
Full moon, you might get some.
Boy, you even on a full moon, you'd
not much.
Yeah, you're not going to see a shadow of a on a house.
No.
Into the shadow, into the, in fact, the film also means shade. It serves as the basis of Teslim, image or likeness. You know, when Yahweh says, and my Teslim, my image and likeness, I made them. So they have come into the likeness of my support structure. And what is the word there? Korah. Korah means my beams, my thick planks of wood, the major weight-bearing rafters and joists used to this is really an interesting thing. So you've got shadow, and you've got support structure. Of course, the big issue, of course, is speech. So I've long enjoyed the quip you probably heard me say. It. I know you think you understand what you thought I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. In this case, it's likely that Lot said one thing and the Sodomites heard another. But in the light of day, without being embroiled in the passion of the moment and with all the time in the world to plumb the depths of each potential nuance and with an eye on the prize, we're in a position to understand why he made this provocative declaration. He was not offering his daughters up to be raped, but was instead presenting them as a contrast. His daughters were unfamiliar and unacquainted with man's ignorant ways, having chosen to remain unresponsive and uninformed regarding the beliefs of humankind. As such, they served as the embodiment of a lone prerequisite of the covenant, disassociating from babble of man. Lot's offer was extended to liven the narrative, bringing our attention to these details. The choice, then, for the marauding masses of morons was to have their way with the women, which wasn't going to happen, or listen to Yahweh's messengers, of which they had no interest. If they had chosen the former, they would not get either. They wouldn't have been allowed to speak to the latter. Since it is unconscionable that a father would sacrifice his virgin daughters to be gang-raped by an unruly mob, and would even beg them to do so, especially on behalf of two Malach, neither of whom he knew, and both of whom could easily have fended off the weasels at the door, as evidenced by the fact that they were about to obliterate the entire town. There was a reason why these words came from Lot's mouth. And there has to be a reason that the religious translations of this story are so misleading. So, here's my secular tone. Not only wasn't Lot responsible for Yahweh's Malach messengers, they were actually responsible for him. Lot wasn't there to protect the Malach. The Malach were there to protect he and his family. Mm-hmm. As spiritual beings, the Malach are immortal and cannot be harmed, only controlled. There was nothing Lot could do that would have had any benefit to the Malach. Not inviting them into his home, not feeding them unyeasted bread, not offering to protect them. Moreover, had they actually been human and vulnerable, what could one man and the door to his home do to stave off every man in an entire city? Just as Abraham knew that Yahweh.
Maybe it was like John Wick or John Rambo or something.
Yeah. Even as Rambo, he's going to stop the entire town. And he couldn't stop his daughters from raping him. Just as Abraham knew that Yahweh, as his heavenly father, loved Yitzhak even more than he did, and therefore wasn't about to let anyone take the life of the first child of the covenant, Lot, as a member of Abraham's family, knew that with Yahweh's Malach spiritual messengers in his home, his daughters were safe as such. Just as Yahweh would have Abraham and Yitzhak act out Pesach on behalf of the covenant, directing our attention to the Mikra in conjunction with the covenant immediately after these events would transpire in Sodom. The would-be sacrifice of Lot's daughters was designed to convey an equally important message. God was revealing the nature and manifestations of what we are being spared from when we rely on Him. This fractured family of Lot, this despicable culture of Sodom, is expressly what we are being spared from. This is the alternative. This story is put in this place between the sixth and meeting between Yahweh and Abraham, where the final condition of the covenant is presented, and the affirmation of the covenant on Mount Moriah. It's put there because Yahweh wants us to understand this is what man's all about. This is what the covenant's all about. I am sparing you from one. I want you to disassociate from one so that you can participate in the other. Very important insight. That's why this story is being told to us. You know, our first clue in this process, from moving past the implausible and to the sublime, was Lot's initial rebuff to the onslaught of corrupt humanity. He said, please, no, certainly not. I beg you, my brothers, this is bad. Ra'ah, this is disturbing and distressful. It's troubling and harmful, ruinous and destructive. Having their way with his daughters was man's way, and Lot knew that man's way was evil. Further, he was aware, and so should we, that man's way is reflected in his religious beliefs, his political views, his societal condition, his family values. These things were all on display this dark night in the broad and open way. Our second clue is found within the preposition law, which in this case must be rendered consider by way of contrast, rather than the more typical draw near and approach. The third insight is related to the first. Because Lot, knowing that they would not listen to reason, realizing that they wouldn't recognize the truth, if it was presented on a silver platter, offered them a mirror. Asher, Lo, Yada, Ish. Revealing the way of man by presenting individuals who are equally naive, unfamiliar, unaware, indeed ignorant. That's Lo, Yada. Ignorant, unaware, unfamiliar. Beyond this comparison, there is also the stunning contrast, recognizing that Asher, Lo, Yada, Ish, infers that Lot's daughters had rejected the ways of men, that they were unacquainted with their stupidity, and that they were unresponsive to the revelations of humankind. Now, guys, I think all of these, I think it's like 10 points that can be derived, because this is a really powerful statement that Lot makes. And I think it's better probably to share it while we're still broadcasting as opposed to just recording.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you a question. Really an awesome story, a whole new way of looking at this.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
And it makes sense. Yeah. It fits when you get rid of, you scrub your mind of that preconceived notion that you've been taught your whole life. It's like, mm-hmm. You look at the words just for what they say, you're like, yeah, that's, yeah, I've been told that's what it means, but, that doesn't really fit.
Well, it's like your question on the bar. I mean, there's 1,447 times the bar shows up, and none of them have anything to do with sex. I mean, come on. You look them all up.
Never.
So how ridiculous. Right. But, Michael, my question is Lord, at this point, it sounds like a pretty moral guy. I mean, he knows the truth. He's serving Matzah. He's concerned about his family. He understands that they're here in his house with him, and he's safe and so forth. All of a sudden, real soon, he's just going to turn about face. I mean, his daughters even seem like they're not acquainted with anything, and all of a sudden, they've got this crap going on in their brain in less than a what is that?
Yeah, I deal with that in this chapter. You realize that this statement is just stunningly profound, and then it's shortly thereafter, Lot falls apart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion that I drew is that there are times where Yahweh chooses for all of our benefit and for no one's detriment. Mm-hmm. To not suspend free will, but to engage in such a way that he puts his words in someone's mouth. Now, is there any negative for Lot to have God's insights be spoken through him to the Sodomites?
No.
Is there were the Malach capable of doing that?
Well,
yeah. 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 Inspiring to see those insights? Absolutely. So there was nothing that was harmful to Lot. And Lot's being set up as an example for all of us to understand. So for him to be inspired by those two Malach to make these profound statements and then just become regular old Lot thereafter,
yeah,
is one of a number of places where God intervenes in such a way to convey a message that no one is harmed, even though there is a suspension of free will, but a diminishment, if you will, of that for God to speak through someone. You know, it isn't much different than being Yashayah or Yirmiyah or Hosha.
They're
not of their own free will saying, well, you know, this is what God said, but, you know, I see it a little differently. I'm going to write it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, they're going to say, this is what I was inspired to write, and this is what God said, and this is what the... So there are times where God does intervene that way, and I think that is what we're witnessing here. And I think that if you do what you did, which I think is really important to say, how is it that this guy is so astute and then is a dunderhead?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, this is exactly how prophecy works when God is speaking through someone. When they are surrendering some of their free will to work with Yahweh in this manner.
Yeah.
And by the way, it happens a lot. And it should happen in every relationship. You know, Terry's not feeling good, so. But if she were to say, you know, I'm finally gonna get up and I want to go out and you know, I'm feeling really crappy. Do I look okay, Kirk? And he would say, no, you look like shit. You know, no. You know, you look like a woman that's been sick for the last month. No, you look terrible. Are you gonna say that?
No, sir.
Of course not. You know, there are things that we just, you know, in a relationship, you just don't do.
Yeah.
And by the way, you wouldn't even think it, even if it were true. You'd just be delighted that she's feeling good enough to go out. You'd be thrilled.
You look just fine.
You look great. Let's go out. I can't wait.
You look great to me.
Yeah, and that's all that matters. So, there, in this relationship with Yahweh, there are times where it is appropriate just to let things happen. Over the course of 18 years, I've written 18 books on insights that I've gleaned from Yahweh. And I've never been one to say, you know, I was inspired by the Spirit or to convey them, because, you know, if you're making that statement, then you better be right all the time. So I don't like to do that. I much prefer to say, you know, this is the words, they're there. Anybody wants to spend the time with these words and think about them, they're going to come to the same insights. They're there just for everybody. But, you know, there's just way too many of them. There's thousands of them. And so somewhere along the way, you're just turning over your time to be used as a tool to convey a message. To be used. And that's one of the things that I came to in this study, is that just as you know, Yah would say of Yirmiyah, I knew you before you were born. You know, which means that everything that you've endured in your life was really setting you up to be effective in this particular way. Moshe, you know, the being in a basket so that your name could be to draw out, and then being part of a Pharaoh's family so that you understand the religion and the politics of the place so that you'd be a more effective witness on my behalf. Moshe was used. He was used. And we have this tendency as people to think, well, being used is derogative, you know, derogatory. It's what right, you know, does anybody have to use another? Well, man, if you're being used by the creator of the universe, that's a really cool thing.
Great.
Yeah. Great. But you are being used. keep in mind you're being used. And it's a good thing. And so that's what I look at so many, like Lot. There are moments where he's being used. There are moments where the statements that Abraham is making are such that God's using him. Mm-hmm. The benefits were overwhelming for Abraham. And there isn't a single moment that Abraham, even now looking back on, say, well, God, you really used me there. No. I'm glad you used me there. Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to be with me.
Thank you for not making me look like an idiot. Exactly. I usually look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I was translating a passage in the first Mizmor, and one of the things that Dode said is that, you know, if you're really meditating upon the Torah, if you find great joy and delight in the Torah, you are never going to lose. And I've done 10,000 radio interviews. If we're talking about something that's important to Yahweh, I've never lost. Ever. Never even been close to it. You know, I can walk out and have an argument with somebody, you know, work in the backyard and lose. But when it comes to Yahweh stuff, I'll lose just because I find great joy and delight and meditating on His Torah, which is what that statement says. And why we do that, we're going to find that there's a lot of times that we just accept what Yahweh has to say. I mean, there's a number of things that we read that say, boy, I wish it wouldn't say that. I wish the Israelites hadn't been, you know, hadn't done that. And I wish God had been a little more easygoing on, like, picking up sticks on the Shabbat. You know, I wish he'd been a little more straightforward on what each of the seven Moed Mikre represent and the like. You know, there's lots of things. But ultimately, it's His story. It's His home. Where life is a byproduct of what He created. The universe is His creation. He's a lot smarter than we are. It's just a whole lot better to accept His perspective, to see it His way.
And just benefits.
You know, most of the time when you do that, you know, like, you know, JBA, before you studied circumcision, you may have been saying, come on, let's make this symbolic. And God doesn't give you the opportunity of symbolism on, well, there is symbolism, but you can't just rely on symbolism with circumcision. You either are or you're not physically circumcised. And you might say, gosh, you know, I'm kind of with Paul on this. Let's not make such a big deal out of it. But, you know, the more you think about it and you understand what it represents and how there was no stipulation as to how much is cut or who does the cutting and that it's done on the eighth day when the blood coagulates better than at any time in our lifetimes. And what it all represents, like this idea of being set apart and the health implications and the like. After a while, you say, even on those things where you may not have agreed initially, you end up agreeing over time. Like, I was very frustrated that when I figured out that that time itself is defined by the seven Moed Mikre, and that they are the path to us home, and that the benefits of the covenant are offered through them. And the reason I was frustrated, why didn't you just make it clear? And then over time you say, because if he did, and people could just do it,
it wouldn't have been worth it.
Yeah, and what you'd end up with is a lot of disingenuous people who don't belong in heaven that would make it a miserable experience for the rest of us just because without thinking, without understanding, they just did it.
Yeah.
So,
you're talking about that was literally the only reason I started delving into circumcision like I did was because initially I was like, yeah, what I was reading was, yeah, this is something you must do. And that was just such a foreign idea in terms of, you know, it's really the only physical thing that, you know, Yahweh has this, like, you know, literally, you are out of the covenant if you do not physically do this. And that was
right.
Such an odd concept to me that I'm like, okay, I've got to understand this better if I'm going to get on board with it. And so, I just started delving into it. And as I came through it, it's like, well, no, duh, this makes sense now. It's perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, I completely came to agree with it because I understood it.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, I know you want to go, but a little past.
I hope that is a decent answer to your question, Kirk, because the question that you asked is a question that was really not only important as we go through the story, but turned out to be such an awakening. This is how the prophets worked, and this is how God works. I mean, if you're going to be used by him, you are a tool. You know, that original idea of, you know, just a dirty and dinged up implement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's still useful.
Yeah.
Old beat up.
Maybe the rusted, dusted, you know, decaying old tool in the toolbox, but at least I'm still useful.
And you know something? It's only those that are used.
Yeah.
They're the only ones that are used. The bright, shiny ones are never used. They're really big ones.
Are perfect tools in the toolbox.
No.
In all of human history, I think the closest one to that might have been Doe.
Oh, and he was as flawed as they come.
Yeah.
But he was the best. Yeah, just clearly he was the best.
Hey, that's an old rusty hammer that you've had for 50 years, and you know, but it works. It does the
job. It feels good. Yeah, it feels good.
A lot. Yeah. It's got that right.
It's not made out of pot metal where you hit the nail and it breaks apart. It's tested and true. Exactly. What do you want to say, Kirk? Do you have something else?
No, I was when you were doing about a verse there, you have a little section in there when you commentary when you go micro. And the M, of course, stands for ask the questions who, what, where, when, and why. What's your six? I was thinking while I was looking at it while you were doing commentary, and I was like, well, the Mikra and God is one, man is six, and God has one answer, and read and recite, you know, and so.
Right, there's six questions. There's six questions you can ask, and there's one answer.
But he only has one answer. Go there.
That's right.
And I thought, isn't that interesting how it works? I don't know.
I would never think it's a trick.
Not at all.
It's all good. Yeah. I mean, it's all good.
Oh, it is. It is. I think we'll just start right back on this statement, and we may end up doing a whole show on the 10 insights that can be gleaned from this one statement, because there's a lot to be learned by it. We're not in any hurry.
Oh, that's a...
And by the way, for those that are listening now, just to the archive of this, there's only one reason that we're telling this story now, because this chapter is the chapter that precedes Yeshayah 17. 18:17 is one of the most prophetically important chapters in the entire of Yah's witness, and 18 is the condemnation of the United States for the role that it plays in what's happening in Yeshayah 17. These are the two chapters that precede it, and the two chapters that precede it are focused entirely on Moab. And they were written in a time that Moab as a kingdom didn't exist. And yet they focus on the destruction of a kingdom that had already been destroyed. So the reason for this story is to try to understand what Moab represents. And the first time that Moab is mentioned, Moab is the eldest son of Lot. And Moab is introduced to us as a byproduct of Sodom. And then Moab and Sodom are equated. And so we're telling this story so that we come to understand what Moab represents today. But we're just going to learn a lot along the way.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, fellas. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat to
Look forward
too.
To being happy
here. Shabbat.
Yeah. Happy Shabbat.
See you next week.
Take care.
Bye.